Your Humanities Half Hour is brought to you by the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.
Half hour. We're coming to you today with a recording from the island of Tinian, and our guest today is the Chief of Staff of the Mayor of the Municipality of Tinian, Mr. Don Farrell. Don, welcome back to your Humanities Half Hour.
Thank you very much, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here for the PICA Festival this weekend. Lots of excitement happening.
Oh, it's going to be far and away the biggest we've ever had. I happened to meet Norman Tenorio up at Joe Tens yesterday afternoon when I was shopping, picking up some last minute things for the volleyball tournament, and Norman said that all of his boats are sold out.
Yes, the boat charters.
Now, in the past, we've been lucky to half fill half of the boats he brought down. So if that's any indicator, then we can see a big time event here on Tinian this weekend.
Well, that's one of the things that makes Tinian unique is its reputation for the Donisali hot pepper. But our topic today is actually something a little bit older than that, than the festival, which is the history and role of Tinian in Operation Forager, and what's going to be happening this year in June to commemorate that event, the World War II history of the islands. Let's start with Operation Forager itself. What was this all about?
Well, Admiral Ernest King, who was the commander-in-chief of the entire United States Navy, Atlantic and Pacific, focused on the Pacific War because he had been a Pacific aircraft carrier commander during his years before the war, and so he had a personal affection for Pearl Harbor, and he took it pretty hard on December 7th. So he was the one who had overall strategy for the war in the Pacific, and he recognized very early on that, in his own words, the Marianas were the key to the Pacific, because all of the supplies coming, all of the equipment, the new aircraft and ships and men coming into the southern islands passed through the Marianas. All that headquarters up there, the Japanese First Naval Air Division headquarters, every brand new Japanese aircraft that arrived, that went overseas, had to stop at Tinian first. That was the pilot's first test for long-term over-air navigation, and it was the first test for the equipment itself. So they all got, once they got here, they were all debriefed and the equipment was fixed, and they went out to the various islands that had been occupied by Japan. So Admiral King told Admiral Nimitz there was no way that we could continue with the plan to cross the Pacific to the Philippines without eliminating the problem in the Marianas. And that is how Operation Forager came about.
When was Operation Forager, and what did it involve?
The final decision on Operation Forager was made right after the raid on Truk Lagoon on February 17th and 18th, when the Navy sailed out of Majuro to attack what was then called Truk Lagoon, the big Japanese naval base down there. When they arrived at Truk, they found out that the Japanese had snuck out the back door. The fleet wasn't there. There were a few ships left, and they sank a lot of ships, and those are the ones that people dive on today if they go down to Truk Lagoon. But the majority of the fleet was gone. So Admiral Spruance took his battle fleet, that's the battleships and the carriers and stuff, back to Pearl Harbor. But he told Admiral Mitcher, who was in command of the Fast Carrier Task Force, to run up to the Marianas and take a peek, see what was the status, what was the condition of those islands. And so he did. And so on February 22nd, 23rd, that was the first day that America attacked the Northern Marianas. It was the day that so many people on Saipan, Tinian, Rota, Pagan lost their homes, lost their businesses, lost their lives. That was the first raid. And during that raid, of course, they took photographs. With that, they went back to Pearl Harbor. At Pearl Harbor, Admiral Nimitz said, we'll move forward the invasion of the Marianas to June 15th. Right now, their defensive positions are not in good situation. We've got to get there before they're really dug in. So he was moving it up to June 15th. So June 15th became the D-Day for Saipan.
I've heard that on that day when you would look out on the horizon from Saipan, because of course they invaded Saipan first, hundreds of ships, if I'm not mistaken, just along the horizon.
535 combat ships, stretching all the way from Pagan to Guam. 15 aircraft carriers, each of them with about 50 aircraft on board. The sky, I mean, they established air superiority within one day. They just wiped out the Japanese Air Force and the Marianas in one day. And then following that event, in came what was called the fast battleships. These were all the new guns coming into town. 2 days later, much to General Saito's dismay on Saipan, and especially Admiral Naguno, here came the old battleships that had been brought off the bottom of Pearl Harbor. They called them the old fleet. And they started the bombardment.
Wait, they raised battleships off the bottom of Pearl Harbor?
Absolutely. RCBs and construction engineers pulled up, all except the Arizona. Of course, the Arizona's
still there today. Mm.
So, Naguno looks out, and here is a fleet beyond imagination. I was told by a veteran who flew over that when he got halfway between Guam and Saipan, he could not see either end of the fleet from the air.
Wow. A big show of force there. Now, my understanding is that there were days of air bombardment on the island from maybe ships and also aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Several days of bombardment, and that was horrendous, but the Japanese were well prepared for that and well trained. I mean, in their Bushido code, their code of honor was very strong, and they came out very quickly. We lost we had 2,000 casualties between the 2nd and 4th Marine Division along the western beaches of Saipan on D-Day. It was horrific. They did not reach their first day's objective, but we had overwhelming force. Unfortunately, the Americans had underestimated the number of Japanese defenders on Saipan by 50%. Mm. So Spruance had sailed with the 2nd Marine Division and the 4th Marine Division as a spearhead, and then the 27th Army Infantry Division as their floating reserve. When the Japanese fleet came out to fight on June 17th, 18th, he had to commit the Army. That meant that he had to postpone the invasion of Guam. Guam had been bombarded on the same day that every other island had. So by then, the Japanese knew where the landing beaches on Guam. The invasion of Guam had to be postponed until they could bring in a whole other infantry division from Oahu, from Hawaii. That's why all of those atrocities occurred on Guam. Very sad.
My understanding is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Americans allowed the Japanese, or led the Japanese to believe it, that the invasion of Saipan was actually going to happen from the east. Is that correct?
No.
No, they knew all along it was going to be the west.
No, they had a plan that they had put together called A-GO a long time ago. After the Battle of Midway, they knew that they would never have superiority at sea. In other words, an equal or greater number of battleships. That means that they couldn't face them down and expect to win. You would only take on those odds in desperate states like Nelson at Trafalgar or something like that, right? So their game plan was to draw the American fleet deep into Japanese waters within the TTPI area, the Micronesian area, where they had land-based bombers on small islands dotted throughout the Pacific. Theoretically, their bombers would take out half of the American aircraft carriers and battleships before they got to the battle area. Then the Japanese would have gunpowder equality, and would have a chance to win an ultimate battle, which they would do in accordance with their great battle at Tsushima against the Russians when they crossed the Russian T in the Straits of Tsushima and sunk the entire Russian Navy in one day. So So anyway, Spruance went out, faced the Japanese, and the Battle of the Marianas Turkey Shoot, right? The Battle of the Philippine Sea and all of that. So the battle went on, and the island was declared secured on July 9th. But already, the Seabees and the Army engineers had landed and started building runways, getting the island ready for its intended purpose.
Let's talk a bit before we go on to the post-invasion development of the islands. What happened here on Tinian specifically with the strategy to attack Tinian?
Oh, well, that was that was sheer Marine and Navy ingenuity. The landing down here was supposed to take place at San Halim Bay, right between Tacchonia Beach and what is now the dock. Remember that there was no dock there before the war. There was just a barrier reef on which now the breakwater is built. So the 2nd, 4th Marine Divisions, who had captured Saipan and lost 25% of their effective force in that battle, 1 out of 4 was out of action. Tells you something about the deal those guys had gone through. They had 2 weeks to get ready to do it again on Tinian. Now, they knew it would be less on Tinian for a bunch of reasons. They knew that there would be fewer defenders, that they had lesser guns, that the Japanese on Tinian would be fully aware that the Japanese had their navy was lost, that there would be no cavalry coming over the horizon. They were dead meat, right? And so there was a huge stockpile of delicious, from what I'm told, fermented Tinian beverages all over the island, and they got whacked. And so it came battle time. They were simply always slow to react. The men were, they knew they were going to die. So they sucked down sake and all a lot of stuff, scotch, all brewed here from the Sugar Cane factory. So the battle didn't last very long. The Americans were fearful of getting slaughtered at the beach, and if they would have landed down there, there'd have been a lot of dead down there because of the guns around the back of the bay. But the Marines said, look, we don't have to do this again. Isn't there an easier way? So there's these two tiny little beaches up on the northwest side, and the Seabees came up with the answer. They created what was called a doodle bug, and it was a large ramp, a ramp heavy enough to hold an amphibious tractor or tank or armored vehicle or something like that, out of the I-beams from the sugarcane factory and railroad ties from the Japanese narrow gauge railroad. So they built this ramp, and then they latched it on top of an amphibious tractor at about a 15 degree angle, and when the invasion started, they simply scooted around the corner from PIC, that beach there, came right in at North Beach and butted that thing up against the reef, then backed the tractor out from under it, the ramp flopped in the water, and all the guys offshore just rode right up the tractors. They were called doodle bugs. They took only 124 casualties on that day, compared to 2,000 on the first day on Tinian because of that. It was pretty cool.
You've mentioned a couple times now the importance of the Seabees in, number one, securing the islands, and what came after.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a monument here on Tinian specifically dedicated to the Seabees.
You know, several of them, actually. The Seabees were phenomenal. During the invasions of Saipan and Tinian, they were not Seabees. They were actually attached to the Marine Corps. They wore Marine Corps uniforms. They carried Marine Corps equipment. They were Marines until they got to the beach. And then they became Seabees again.
What does Seabees stand for?
Naval Construction Battalions. The Naval Construction Battalions is a wonderful story about a bunch of men who wanted to go to war and were too old. These were foremen and factory operators and guys who were certainly not going to carry a rifle into battle, right? But they wanted to do something, and they wanted to be in the front. Well, the Navy needed people that would go forward, right, and build bases. and build bridges and build all the things that the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy needed for the Pacific War. So they created the first Naval Construction Battalion. It usually consisted of about 1,100 men. In the original battalions, they were all volunteers. And there were very few young guys. They mostly came out of construction companies in America, right? They knew how to work steel. They knew how to work wood. They knew how to build things, right? Use jackhammers and all of that kind of stuff. So when they knew how to drive bulldozers and heavy equipment. They worked in some of the mines and forests of America and stuff like that. And so the first Naval Construction Battalion was created, and then one more and one more. By the time they got to Tinian, there were 13 naval construction battalions assigned to build the roads and bridges, not bridges, the roads and the runways and all of the facilities on Tinian. 12,500 men, plus several special detachment CBs who did things like making gases for the acetylene torches and stuff like that. And they were amazing people.
Now, during World War II, Northfield here on Tinian was the busiest runway in the world.
Yep, absolutely.
What was going on?
Oh, it was... We will learn more during the 70th, because there's going to be about 24 real live B-29ers here. Now, they're all old.
I can imagine.
But, yeah.
It's been a while.
They've got stories to tell. You know what I mean? So anyway, but... how do I explain it? There were 12,500 men in the 313th Bomb Wing. So those were the Army Air Force guys. They were up there. There was two companies of Marines from the 8th Marine, 3rd Battalion, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines. They were the guards around all of the, to prevent sabotage. Because remember, we had 11,500 refugees on the island. By the end of the war, there were over 75,000 people on Tinian, all drinking Tinian water. It wasn't so much Donny because they bulldozed it. But anyway, so I am told that during a full pull mission, that means out of the 313th Bomb Wing, there's four bomb groups. Each bomb group has three bomb squadrons of 15 aircraft. So during
the math on that.
So during, and each of those aircraft have four 12-cylinder huge engines. I'm told by the vets that have been here before that when a full pull mission came off, they had each of the four groups lining up at the end of each of the four runways. When the go signal was given, the lead aircraft would take off from runway Able. 30 seconds after he left there, still not off the ground, a plane took off from Baker, and then a plane from Charlie, and then a plane from Delta. Meantime, another plane was pulled into into station at Able, and so every 30 seconds until all of those aircraft are airborne.
Making bomb runs on Japan.
All of them headed for some target in Japan. Each of them, actually, each group having sometimes different assignments, not dropping the same kinds of weapons. The 505th Bomb Group, they were involved in what was called Operation Starvation, which was dropping aerial mines in the harbors and sea routes around the Japanese main islands to prevent either military cargo from leaving or supplies from coming to the main island. And the objective was, if the president should decide not to use the bomb or not to to invade, they would have starved that winter. There was no food. There was no coal for heating their houses. They didn't have anything. So that was the 505th Bomb Group, the 504th, the 9th, and the 6th. Sometimes they shared missions. Sometimes it all depended on what General LeMay wanted from Guam.
Well, we've mentioned a couple times now the 70th anniversary of Operation Forger that's coming up in June. Let's talk a little bit more about that after our break.
Okay. That's a fun story.
And we'll be back after this.
Hafa Day, this is Eulalia Villagomez of the Northern Marianas Humanities Council. Did you know that you can donate up to $5,000 to the Humanities Council through the CNMI Education Tax Credit Program? Donations from individuals and corporations qualify and can be used to offset your local wage and salary tax, DGRT, and earnings tax. Call our office at 235-4785 to see how you can support humanities programs in our community and obtain a tax credit for your donation. Thank you and Sizus Masi.
Welcome back to Your Humanities Half Hour. We're speaking today with Dawn Farrell, Chief of Staff of the Mayor of the Municipality of Tinian, and we're talking about Operation Forager and, more importantly, the 70th anniversary of that military campaign that's going to be celebrated in June here in Tinian and Saipan. Dawn, I have to say, the first half of our show, you mentioned there were some veterans who are coming back to celebrate this occasion with you on Tinian, and you got teary-eyed.
Oh.
Why is that?
That's not a fair question. My dad drove a landing craft in Iwo Jima and Okinawa. He delivered wounded here to Tinian.
So it's very personal for you. We can edit this.
Okay.
See, he drove landing aircraft.
No, he drove. He landed on the beach. He drove a landing craft to the beach.
Okinawa and where?
Iwo Jima, and then Okinawa.
Iwo Jima.
When you see the movies of the boats, the first wave headed to the beach.
Yeah.
The one for Iwo Jima. If you see flags for our fathers or letters from Iwo Jima, or John Wayne, Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
You always know where my dad is. He's the last white one on the left. That little, because all you see is these streaks headed for the beach.
Yeah.
The last white streak, that's my dad's in there, shitting his pants.
Is that what he said?
No, he didn't say that. I said that. He'd kick my ass if he knew I said that. Okay.
Let's pick up from...
Right. I do a lot of military historical tours, so I hear a lot of veteran stories. And then I just got back from a cruise listening to...
Wait, let's pick up there.
Okay.
Go ahead. We ended with your dad drove landing, and then go ahead with your statement.
Well, I do... One of the great pleasures that I've had after studying the battle history of the Marianas is to give tours to visiting veterans groups and individual veterans. So military historical tours, Dollar tours, Ambrose tours, they all bring groups of veterans to Tinian two or three times a year. And generally speaking, I ride along with them and tell stories about whatever they want to hear, wherever they go. But after that's over, I get to go sit down with them at the hotel or wherever and listen to their stories. So I've gotten to listen to some wonderful accounts of these once very, very young men who ended up on this island, and asked them questions about, you know, what do they remember? What stuck out in their mind most, other than the battle going on around them? And the answers have always been so good.
Now, these veterans that are coming, they must be about 90 years old.
There's not one that young.
They're over 90. Why? And we hope to have an opportunity to talk to them when they come, but why do you feel they're coming back?
Oh.
Have they expressed to you?
These people get together quite often. They have veterans associations, right? So I guess that's how it got started. I communicate with lots of veterans organizations to keep them. They're interested in the new military development of Tinian. So I keep them up to speed on that. And when the decision was made to have a 7th anniversary thing here, I told them it was going to happen, and they put it in their newsletters, and one thing led to another, and now all of a sudden all of these people are coming here. So some of them know each other because they're from the same organization in the same town, but a lot of them are going to be meeting each other for the first time, even though they served together here on Tinian. And they all served here on Tinian, right? Not only flyboys, the B-29ers, some of the Marines are going to be here that guarded their aircraft. And I'm sure they don't remember each other. So the exciting part about it is the ceremony up there is going to be... It's going to be great. It's going to be good. It's going to be memorable, right? But to me, again, the more fun part is for me to go down and sit in the dynasty with them, you know, while they talk to each other and share their stories. about their time on Tinian. Just like my dad when he came out for the Iwo Jima trip some years ago. Best part of the trip for me was sitting on the sideline and watching my dad talk to a guy that rode in the same boat that he took to shore that they had never met before. I'm never going to get to hear those stories from my dad. He's never going to volunteer that. But they talk to each other. So you're going to see them bantering back and forth about which squadron was the best squadron and who flew the most dangerous missions and who dropped the most bombs and who was the best pilot and all that kind of stuff. And they're all 90 years old. And it's going to be just hugely fun. But I did have a meeting this morning with the 70th Anniversary Committee, which is chaired by Ben Camacho out of the governor's office. Good guy. Very, very strong leader. And Gordon Marciano was there. Of course, it was at the MBA, so they're all participating. And we are working on a mechanism to make sure that the public has a free opportunity to meet with these veterans.
So give us the date of the anniversary and what are some of the activities planned?
Okay, again, I probably should refer you to Ben, right, or Gordon Marciano, but we know that the ceremony here on Tinian will be on June 12th at about 10 o'clock. Admiral Payne will be our keynote speaker. The mayor, the governor will give welcoming remarks. Lieutenant General Snowden from the Marine Corps, retired, a Tinian veteran. Right, we'll speak for the Marine Corps. There will be one of the veterans from the 313th Bomb Wing will deliver some remarks, and then we have a Japanese veteran who is going to say a few words. So that's on the 12th, and then on the 14th is the big Humanities Council History Conference, the World War II History Conference. Great setup. Again, Scott Russell's got all of the Humanities Council. I think it's on their website. And then on the 15th, which is actually the 70th anniversary of the landings on Saipan, there'll be a parade in the morning, and then there is an honor ceremony in the afternoon at the American Memorial Park, where they'll be presenting those medallions of honor to all of the veterans who served in the Marianas who have not yet received one.
So June 12th to 15th, we want to invite the community to make some time, whether they're here in Tinian or on Saipan, to be a part
of it. And let's make sure that our young people get out there to meet some of these. Yeah. I hope school is out by then.
I'm not sure if it will be out.
Yeah. But anyway, anybody who has an opportunity to sit and say hello, these people are always very open.
You know, we're sitting here in the mayor's office, and you keep looking at and you keep gesturing over to this photo of Northfield. It's an aerial photo from World War II.
Yeah.
This also applies to Saipan, but very much so, I think, here in Tinian. The history, every place you turn, you see Broadway. I mean, you're driving on roads that were built by the military.
Yeah, that was a CB idea. The CB that made up the roadways was from Manhattan Island.
Yeah. What do you think this anniversary means to the community?
Oh. I'll guarantee you there's going to be a very large crowd up there. And we have other events scheduled for them before and afterwards, the different groups. They've got some beach barbecues and stuff like that. From a mayor's office perspective, the international publicity for Tinian is going to be huge. There will be Japanese media, there will be American media. That many veterans are going to draw public attention. So that means that the word of Tinian is going to get out to the public and to the outside of the Mariana Islands, and that's important to us. To the average people here on Tinian, I think it's a source of pride. I think it's a great source of pride. Of course, there's nobody alive on Tinian today who was on the island at that time, right? It's all a great story, but so many of them arrived here so shortly after the base was shut down that they remember the huts and the buildings the way they were. And so to get a chance to meet some of the guys that were up there, they enjoy that. I see them show up. Yeah. It's heartfelt.
Don, any final thoughts before we go today?
I think mostly that it's important to remember these events. It was catastrophic for the Marianas. The Operation Forager, had the military decided for some reason to bypass Guam, we would still have a lot of the architecture left from the German and Japanese administrations that were lost due to the bombardment. The displacement of people would not have happened, and therefore the reorganization of the entire reorganization of the social structure of the Marianas, but particularly on Tinian. And it meant it was a turning point in the history of the Marianas, certainly in the history of Tinian. But for the Marianas in general, it was a turning point in that American attention was focused on the strategic value of the Mariana Islands. So even though the islands haven't been reunified as they should have been a long time ago, they are still they're now under the same flag for the first time. At this point, they were reunified under one flag, although not politically reunified as one territory. So I think that from a historical perspective, it was a turning point in the history of the Marianas.
We've been speaking today with Don Farrell, Chief of Staff of the Mayor of the Municipality of Tinian, talking about Operation Forager, the campaign for the Marianas, and the upcoming 70th anniversary of that occasion. Don, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Kathy. My pleasure always.
This has been your Humanities Half Hour. I'm Catherine Perry.
This program was supported by a We the People grant awarded to the Northern Marianas Humanities Council from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities or the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.